rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time, Friday morning. Time for Brunch with Bernie, the first hour of our Friday program, as it has been for going on low 3 years now, I think. We've had Bernie on every Friday. Congressman Bernie Sanders, the independent from the state of Vermont, the only independent member of the House of Representatives, the longest-serving independent member in the history of the House of Representatives, the 200-and-some-odd-year history of that storied body. And Congressman Bernie Sanders, I think of Bernie as America's congressman, not just as Vermont's congressman, just my personal, although he was my congressman when I lived in Vermont, and I was proud of it. And Bernie's website, bernie.org, our telephone number, toll-free, 866-440-THOM, 440-8466. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com, and just click live chat, it'll get you there. Bernie Sanders, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great having you here. The Republic, well, actually, before we even get to the Republican spin machine, Mr. Foley, Mark Foley, Congressman Mark Foley, I'm curious, two things. Number one, what did you know about him and all this stuff that's going on there? And number two, what's your take on how this is all playing out?
I didn't know Mr. Foley very well. I knew him well enough to say hello in the halls of Congress, but really he's not on any of the same committees that I'm on and didn't have any working relationship with him at all. I think the what's going on, but let me also say that in case there are parents listening today who are interested in the PAGE program in the U.S. Congress is a wonderful, wonderful program, both in the Senate and in the House, and many, many kids have learned an enormous amount. The school there is excellent. Kids got a great experience. So I hope that no parent listening who is thinking about the PAGE program for his or her kids gets turned off by all that has happened. Clearly, Mr. Foley's behavior is despicable. The idea that a member of Congress would be preying sexually as a sexual predator on young kids is beyond comprehension. And that has, we have to make absolutely certain that something like this never, ever happens again. What we also have to do, obviously, is given the fact that the PAGE program ultimately in the House lies under the jurisdiction of the Speaker. The Speaker has to be held accountable and responsible. There is an investigation now going on in a bipartisan way where we will learn, hopefully very soon, about what Speaker Hastert knew and when he knew it. And if, in fact, and I don't want to prejudge this, it's not my style to prejudge or rush to judgment, but if, in fact, information about Mr. Foley's behavior, which some suggest has been public to some degree for a number of years, if, in fact, the Speaker's office did know that and chose not to act in order to protect a safe Republican seat in Florida, then the Speaker has got to accept full responsibility for that. And under those circumstances, I think his resignation as Speaker would be appropriate. But before we make that determination, I think we've got to see what this investigation brings forth. So that's kind of where we're at now. I think clearly also the momentum now for the election as we head to November 7th is very strongly against the Republicans. I think as people look closely at the important issues facing their lives, whether it's the economy and the growing gap between the rich and the poor and the decline of the middle class, whether it is the disintegration of our health care system. Under Bush, 6 million more Americans have lost their health insurance, whether it is the growth of our national debt, which is now $8.5 trillion, whether it is Bush's attacks on Social Security, whether it is the war in Iraq, and we have been learning more and more about Iraq, and just the horrendous situation that now exists there, which is in fact a civil war this month alone. In the few days of this month, we have lost 23 American soldiers already. This looks like it could be one of the worst months in the history of the war. 20,000 Americans have been wounded. I think as people look at the disastrous record of the Bush-Cheney administration and the Republican leadership in the House and the Senate, I think more and more Americans are coming to the conclusion that these guys are not only reactionary, not only working day and night on behalf of large corporations and the wealthiest people in this country, but they're also totally incompetent, and that the level of corruption that now exists in Washington is certainly at a high watermark for modern American history. So I think what our job now is, in the next month, is, having said all of that, to understand the Republicans, in fact, are very good in politics. They do a lot better job than Democrats in getting their votes out, and it seems to me that the area that people should be focusing on right now and in the next month is to see that voter turnout is as large as it possibly can be, that the people of this country who are disgusted with what's going on in Washington come out and vote for fundamental change, both in the House and in the Senate.
You mentioned the word incompetent, Bernie, and I think that a lot of us looking at the Iraq situation certainly immediately and instinctively would agree. There are some doubts some folks have about Louisiana, might not have been incompetence. It might have been something else, political cronyism or something.
But add it all together.
But if we look at the National Labor Relations Board decision earlier this week, the Kentucky River decision, this is not incompetent.
These
guys are actually very competent in some areas, and they've been very successful in destroying the American middle class.
Oh, absolutely. No. By incompetence, I mean is that, you know, I voted against the war in Iraq, helped lead the opposition against the war, but if you go to war, you at least want to have an understanding about what you might anticipate happening when you went to war. Incompetence is when you talk about how this will be a quick and easy victory and our troops will be coming home, and not understanding the nature of the insurgency. Incompetence means that you do not let Americans in New Orleans and in Mississippi die and become homeless and not protect them and not come to their rescue in an appropriate way. That's incompetence. Incompetence is that if you pass a prescription drug Medicare bill, which to my mind is a bad bill, I voted against it, we can make it much stronger, but if you pass even a bad bill, you know how to implement that bill. You know how to have your website working effectively so that people can understand what their options are. That's incompetence.
But don't you think it's possible that perhaps at a certain level with regard to Medicare, for example, that they were really trying to break the system so that they could say, see, it's broken, we should do away with it?
Well, that's a more broad statement, but I think in terms of the prescription drug program, if you're going to campaign on a program and you can't even implement it, you can't even provide the information to seniors as to what's available, I don't think anyone can defend that.
Yeah.
Incompetence is that you can't even run a PAGE program. A PAGE program is a relatively small school run by the United States Congress, and that you can't even keep a good eye on that is incompetent. So I think that there is little doubt that these guys are totally incompetent in terms of public policy. Where they are not incompetent, where they are extremely smart and effective, is in politics. What they do, by and large, their public policy is wrapped around what works for them politically, political gain. They are very effective in knowing how to spin. They are effective in knowing how to deflect attention from the important issues. They are effective in raising zillions of dollars for their candidates. They are effective in smearing and lying about their opposition. And they are effective in bringing out every last vote that they can possibly get. And in the remaining month of this campaign, my hope is that those Americans who are sick and tired of what is going on in Washington will in fact jump with both feet heavily into the political process and not just vote themselves, but make sure that every friend that they have, every family member they have, every coworker that they have gets out and votes for a real change in Washington.
Yeah. A couple of years ago when I was living in Vermont, I gave $5 to the RNC so that I'd get on their mailing list when I started doing this radio show about 4 years ago. And they still think I'm in Vermont. And I just got an email from Ken Melman telling me, click here to get my Vermont absentee ballot so that I can vote immediately. The Republicans are really pushing for people to do absentee voting. Any idea why?
Well, obviously, what they want to see happen is everybody sympathetic. All those people who are sympathetic to them will vote. And one of the best ways to make sure that people are voting is through absentee ballots, because you know that vote is in the bank and you don't have to wait till election day.
Right. Or for another scandal to pull off in your face. Amazing. Yeah, and plus it's you can do it from home, so it's a whole bunch easier. Yeah, interesting. It's 16 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Congressman Bernie Sanders. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Bernie.org, his website. Ours, if you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartman.com. Our number, 866-440-8466. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And where that foghorn blows, I will be coming home. Yeah, when the foghorn blows, I want to be ready. I don't have to fear that I want to rock your gypsy soul.
And welcome back. Listener supported radio. Support our sponsors to support our program, the local sponsors that you're hearing on your local radio station, and our national sponsor, Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, sacredgroundscoffee.com, or you can call them at 1-800-425-2532. Small Dog Electronics, get the latest iPods now, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS, smalldog.com, their website. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, ecowine.com, their website. Tom Hartman program here with you, 22 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Bernie, shall we start taking calls here? Let's do it. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernie. I always enjoy listening to both of you.
Thank you.
I was wondering, after Bernanke's remarks about Social Security, my question is, when exactly does Social Security have to dip into its trust fund, which isn't really there, in order to start paying retirees?
Okay. The Social Security, according to the major studies that have been done by Social Security, one being done by the Social Security Administration itself, one I believe by the GAO, Social Security is going to be able to pay out every nickel owed to every eligible American from between the next 35 to 45 years. And that is probably a conservative estimate because it has a low projection in terms of economic growth. It may well be the Social Security system may be stronger than that. When the president tells us that Social Security is going bankrupt, he is really not telling us the truth. Because even after that 35 to 40 year period, Social Security will then be able to pay out 75 to 80% of the benefits that the American people are entitled to. With modest changes in Social Security, among other things, by currently lifting the cap on the payments that wealthier people make, Social Security can be made totally whole for our kids and our grandchildren. And my view is that that is precisely what we should do. Medicare, unlike Social Security, in fact has very serious long-term financial problems. With modest changes in Social Security, such as lifting the cap, we can make Social Security whole for years and years to come. And that is, in my view, what we should be doing.
Bernie, Ben Bernanke, in his speech, did what I've noticed a lot of conservatives whose ultimate goal is to privatize both Social Security and to destroy Medicare, and conflated the two. He mixed them together
into
this bundle. and attributed many of the problems of Medicare to Social Security. And also, many of the problems of Medicare are the consequence of the fact that we have a private for-profit health system in this country.
Right.
If we had a single-payer health care system, in other words, if Medicare covered every single person in the United States, regardless of age and condition, so then our insurance costs would go down dramatically. We wouldn't have insurance industry executives making $1.5 billion a year
right.
in compensation.
Right.
And we eliminated the cap on Social Security. Wouldn't it be possible to solve both problems?
Absolutely, but they're separate issues, Tom.
Yeah.
And you're quite right. There has been a savage attack on Social Security. Huge lies, huge distortions of the reality. The bottom line is that with modest changes, like asking Bill Gates to contribute more into the Social Security system than somebody who makes $90,000 a year, with those modest changes and a few others, Social Security will be there for our great-grandchildren. Should it be there? Absolutely. Given the volatility in the economy, given the fact that millions of older workers now have lost or are very fearful about losing their pensions, it is terribly important that we have a system there which will, in fact, guarantee retirement benefits, and not only retirement benefits for older people, will help the disabled, and will help widows and orphans when a breadwinner dies.
Yeah, and you're not actually talking about a progressive tax. You're not talking about people making over $90,000 paying more into the system. You're talking about them paying the exact same amount into
exactly.
the system
which
as,
is what
as
we,
everybody else does.
Exactly, which is what we did with Medicare. So Social Security is enormously important for so many people, and that's what it is about. You don't get rich through Social Security. It is security. And you know what, Tom? We take these things for granted. But for the last 70-plus years, with all of the ups and downs in the economy and in the stock market, do you know what? Social Security has paid out 100% of the benefits that every American entitled to that program, for every American entitled to that program.
Right.
That's a pretty good record.
And it operates at 1/20th
right.
of the overhead costs of private pensions.
Now, Medicare, we're talking about another issue, and you raised the important point. When you look at Medicare, you look at Medicaid, it has to be seen within the context of our entire disintegrating healthcare system, a system where costs are spiraling out of control.
And Bill Frist's daddy is becoming a billionaire.
Right.
Yeah. 27 minutes past the hour. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, the independent from Vermont. 1-866-440-8466 to talk with Bernie. Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. Tonight, for our listeners in Seattle, tonight and tomorrow, I'll be up in Seattle tonight at the Town Hall, presented by the Elliott Bay Book Company. I'll be giving a talk on the topic of the death of the middle class in America, the broad arc of the book, my new book, Screwed. Tickets are $5, available at Elliott Bay in advance. 206-624-6600 is their phone number, Elliott Bay Book Company, although we'll be meeting at Town Hall, which is at 8th Avenue in Seneca at 7:30 p.m. And tomorrow at 1 p.m., Congressman Jim McDermott and I will be talking at the Young Democrats meeting in Seattle. That's at the University District Store, sponsored by the University of Washington Young Democrats. And at 6 p.m. tomorrow night, I'll be the keynote speaker for the annual dinner for Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility, WPSR.org, their website. Just a heads up there.
In your spare time.
In my spare time, yeah.
And by the way, I really want to applaud you for focusing on this issue of the collapse of the middle class, because it is an issue of enormous consequence. It is an issue that if we do not turn around, for the first time in the modern history of America, our kids will have a lower standard of living than we do, and it is an issue essentially the corporate media just doesn't talk about. So I'm really glad that you're focusing on it.
Well, thank you, Bernie. Do you have a copy of my new book, Screwed?
Yeah, no, I don't. I will.
Well, during the break, Alex will drop in and during the next break and
get I can pick
whatever
it up.
Address you want it sent to, and we'll send you one.
Beautiful.
We've got a few here from the publisher that we give away on our progressive pop quiz, so we'll get you one. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Jake in Lebanon, Missouri, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, sir. Tom, enjoy your program.
Thank you. If I,
as a small businessman, if I borrow money from the bank, I'm expected to repay it in a timely manner, or they come and take something away from me. The president said that he went over to the Social Security Department and found file cabinets full of IOUs. What if we just cut off all this earmarked pork money that Congress seems to pass every year until the IOUs are paid?
Well, first thought, don't necessarily believe, I don't know how to say this, but do not necessarily believe everything that the president says. The truth of the matter is that the federal government throughout the history of our country has paid off every debt that we have ever had. And if we did not, then the financial well-being not only of the United States and our stability, but the entire world would be thrown in havoc if that was not the case. The issue here is, of course, we have a huge national debt. And, of course, when President Bush took office, he was given a surplus. And for five consecutive years, he has given us significant deficits. And now the national debt is $8.5 trillion. I think what we've got to focus on is why is the deficit so high? And certainly one of the reasons is that this president has thought it appropriate to provide hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1%, to millionaires and billionaires. This president has thought it wise to give no-bid contracts to companies like Halliburton, which have certainly escalated big time the cost of not only the war in Iraq, but the rebuilding of the damage in New Orleans for Hurricane Katrina. This administration has decided to waste hundreds of billions of dollars by passing a prescription drug Medicare program, which unbelievably, at the behest of the pharmaceutical industry, says that we cannot negotiate lower prices with the drug companies so that Medicare is paying sky-high prices and costing us huge sums of money. So, 2 points. Number one, we can solve the Social Security problem, as I mentioned earlier, by some modest changes in the Social Security system, and it will be there for our grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Number two, dealing with the national debt requires standing up, doing away with the tax breaks we have given to the wealthiest people, doing away with stupid programs like building bridges to nowhere at a cost of a couple of hundred million dollars, and doing a number of other things. When Bush inherited the government, we had a surplus. Today we have a huge deficit. We can and must turn that around.
Bernie, if I had $100,000 in my retirement account or whatever, if I had 100 grand and I went out and I bought a $100,000 treasury note, that would be characterized by an investment advisor as an investment. In other words, I'm going to get a return on that investment. Eventually, the government's going to pay me back that $100,000, and all the time that I'm holding that note, I'm getting interest every month or every year. So would it be accurate to say that while Bush, what Bush said is over at the Social Security Trust Fund, there's all this paper, all these treasury notes, but the reality is that the Social Security Trust Fund is invested in treasury bills.
I mean, what Bush is implying is that the faith and credit of the United States of America is in trouble. That's what he's implying, isn't he?
That's a scary thing.
Of course it is. And that the president of the United States, who has given us deficit after deficit, should be talking about this in order to frighten the American people, in the same way he was trying to frighten the American people in terms of suggesting that Social Security was going bankrupt, is really very poor behavior, but not terribly unexpected from this president.
Yeah. Dave in Orlando, Florida, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Bernie. I was wondering if the cargo containers leaving Afghanistan are being inspected, making sure they're not full up with heroin.
Well, what we do know in terms of the inspection of cargo containers, less than 10% of them are being inspected. So I can't give you a definitive answer about what's coming in from Afghanistan, but we can say that one of the certain vulnerabilities that we have as a nation in protecting us is the lack of inspection of cargo containers, which could be bringing God knows what into this country in terms of weapons of mass destruction that could be used against the American people. And this is certainly one of the areas that we've got to do a heck of a lot better job than we are currently doing.
Bernie, Nancy Pelosi says if the Democrats take control of the House and she's the Speaker of the House, on day one she'll put new rules in place to break the link between lobbyists and legislation, and on day two she'll enact all the recommendations made by the 9/11 Commission, which would include inspecting all the containers.
That's right.
Do you think she can pull it off?
Well, of course you can. You know, it's not going to happen in 2 days, but the legislation can be offered in 2 days, and that's exactly what we should be doing. I mean, despite President Bush's constant assertions about how deeply concerned he is about terrorism, time and time again, he has refused not to implement the very important and sensible recommendations from the 9/11 Commission, including making sure that 100% of the cargo coming into this country is inspected.
Carolyn in Tempe, Arizona, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi there, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hi.
Got to tell you both that I'm not very easily impressed, but both of you have my undying gratitude and respect.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to make a quick comment about what you were, Bernie was saying, that these folks in control are excel in politics or getting elected, but they're not particularly competent. I would just like to suggest that they might be competent if they cared, but I think that what we're looking at is that they're amoral. And I think the reason they excel in politics is because they excel in manipulation, because they're just simply not restrained by any pangs of conscience that most of us have. They're just, if you don't have to play by any rules or any ethics, it's a lot easier to get what you want. And they tend to want power, and they oppose equality, and they're simply amoral. And their followers have undue respect for authority figures, and so they don't catch on. And one other thing, if I could just say one other thing. I've sat here and just been stressed out of my mind watching these people dismantle our democracy. And I have read or heard somewhere that the Democrats won't stress what the Republicans, these key Republicans, have been doing, because they think that Americans don't care about process, and they think that's process. So, could you comment on that?
Well, Carolyn, you said a whole lot, and I think you said it very, very well. I think the first point that you made is that these guys don't care, is by and large right. And I don't want to make this a general rule for every Republican in Congress, because that's not the case. There are some decent people there. But by and large, do they particularly worry that 47 million Americans have no health insurance, or that poverty has increased by 5 million people since Bush has been in office, and that we have millions of people today still making a minimum wage of $5.15, the national minimum wage? Do they really worry about those things? No, they don't. On the other hand, are they very good and effective in retaining power and manipulating the system? Are they good in working with the media to deflect attention from the real issues and bring up a lot of straw issues? They are very, very, very good. They are the best that has ever been. I think they do have an advantage over many of us, because if, as Karl Rove certainly believes, that lying is part of your political, the political tools that you have, where you can try to destroy somebody like John Kerry with the so-called Swift Boat veterans, and just completely lie and lie and lie. If these guys believe that it is okay to use the vast majority of Republican money, big article in Washington Post last month, not to talk about issues, but to try to destroy their opponents through negative advertising, that is an advantage they have in the political process. And we got to figure out how to deal with that.
Well said. It's America's weekly town hall meeting. Brunch with Bernie. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie.org, his website, TomHartmann.com, my website. If you're going to drop into our live chat room, drop in there and say hello. Our number, 866-440-8466, the Tom Hartmann radio program. Yeah.
the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't want millions, mister. I don't want your diamond ring. All I want is the right to live, mister. Won't you give me back my job again?
Yeah, wouldn't that be a fine thing? Thank you, Tom Rush, for that. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The True People's Radio, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie.org, his website, TomHartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, our number 866-440-8466 is our telephone number. And Virginia in Grand Rapids, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hello.
So, yeah, I appreciate talking to you, Tom and Bernie. I heard a program yesterday about the demographics of the country and how it's grown, and there was a suggestion made that sounded very interesting about how we really don't have representation. We have too many people, even for 9 justices to take care of, and all the way down that they didn't know a cure, but they made a suggestion there could be some regional legislators or representatives, I mean.
Well, was that a question, Virginia?
Well, I'm really asking you about, has there ever been any movement in that area, or has anybody ever talked about it or thought about it?
If you were to ask me, I think that issue is not the major problem that our democracy faces. The major problem that our democracy faces is that to a very significant degree the political process is controlled by big money, that in order to get elected to office you need a whole lot of money, and either you're wealthy yourself or you kind of follow the lead of those wealthy people and representatives of big companies who make the contributions. I think one of the other serious problems facing our democracy is that the American people are not, through their media, getting the kinds of information they need about really what is going on in their lives in order to make particularly good decisions in many instances. I was complimenting Tom earlier for his new book, which talks about the decline of the middle class. And this is such a huge issue, and yet we have so little national discussion as to why people today are working longer hours for lower wages than used to be the case, why poverty is increasing, why the gap between the rich and the poor is growing, why the huge issues. And yet the American people really don't have an explanation as to why that is happening. We don't have a good understanding as to why we are the only nation in the industrialized world that doesn't guarantee health care to all people, and yet we spend twice as much per person on health care as any other nation. Why is that? So I would say that those are some of the more deeper causes of our political problems.
Well said. 1-866-440-8466. Jack in Redmond, Washington. Hey, Jack.
Hi, Tom. Looking forward to seeing you tonight at Town Hall.
Great. I'm looking forward to being there.
Congressman, would you care to speculate on Karl Rove's complicity in the past and ongoing cover-up of Congressman Foley and the Speaker of the House as well?
No, I wouldn't, because I just don't know, and I'm not much into speculation. I'd like to see the evidence. But I would suggest that Karl Rove certainly has been at the center of the entire Bush strategy and at the strategy of right-wing Republicanism. What Rove understands is that it is terribly important to deflect attention away from the real issues facing the American people. Tom, you'll remember that just a few months ago, I mean, Rove was very public about it. He said, in the coming months up to the election, we will talk about terrorism. You remember that?
All terrorism all the time. Yeah.
All terrorism all the time. And guess what? That's exactly what, up until very recently, Mr. Foley has kind of forced them to talk about something else. That's exactly what they have been doing. How much discussion have we had about
the disintegration of our healthcare system. Virtually
none. Been none. Yeah.
So what the media, what happens is Rove understands that if the president speaks, the media will simply focus on what the president is saying and allow the president to determine what the issues are facing the American people. So what Rove looks at and does a lot of polling and says that terrorism is an issue where the president and Republicans do best. So that is what we will talk about. And the media acts in a way that simply exceeds to what Rove wants. We have lost 2.9 million good-paying manufacturing jobs in the last 5 years, and one of the reasons for that is our horrendous trade policy. Have you seen one word of that on
No.
the front pages of the newspapers? One word of that?
No.
6 million more Americans have lost health insurance since Bush has been president. Cost of health care has soared. President, have anything to say about that? Under President Bush, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of veterans, people who put their lives on the line to defend this country, have been thrown off of VA health care. Any discussion about that issue? Not a word. So what Rove understands is that essentially the corporate media will follow the lead of the president. So you can frame the issues in the way you want it. Rove also understands that you can lie and lie and lie, and the media will not call you a liar. So Rove plays a central role, and it is imperative that we defeat Rove, we defeat right-wing republicanism on November 7th.
Well said, and it's going to take more than just voting. People need to get out there and get active.
Absolutely.
Congressman Bernie Sanders. Bernie, if you could stick around just for a second, Alex needs to talk to you offline.
Sure.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website, the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be getting into the news of the day, what Nancy Pelosi says she's going to do, what happened when the police got the wrong tip, what John Ashcroft is saying about the 9/11 Commission, and an amazing story about Bush and his latest signing statement. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's absolutely incredible. I mean, this is such a perfect example of what is wrong and bizarre with the Bush administration and its Republican support group. Congress passed a law last week. On their way out, the end of the congressional session, the House voted for it, the Senate voted for it. They went into conference. They synthesized it so that it was a bill that both houses of Congress agreed was identical language. Both of them passed it. It went off to the White House to be signed. And what this bill said was that henceforth, now and forevermore, world without end, amen, when the director of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is appointed, and that person, by the way, is appointed by the president, when that person is appointed, actually, it's not a cabinet-level position. Now it's appointed by the president's appointee, which I guess would be Chertoff. When that person is appointed, he or she must, quote, have a demonstrated ability in and knowledge of emergency management and not less than 5 years of executive leadership, end quote. In other words, we don't want another lawyer who used to judge Arabian horses. We want somebody who has at least 5 years of executive leadership. In other words, they know how to run an organization. FEMA is a large institution. It's a multi-billion-dollar agency. A lot of employees and a lot of responsibility. You want somebody who has executive competence and capability, and not just in any old field. You don't want to hire somebody out of the, horse exhibition. It wasn't racing he was doing. It was It was like, you know, dog and cat shows, only the horse version. You don't want that. You don't want somebody who's out of radio or television. You don't want somebody who's out of you know, an executive in the plumbing industry. What you want is somebody who has, to quote the law, a demonstrated ability in and knowledge of emergency management, end quote. Like the guy that Bill Clinton appointed. He had a long background in emergency management. I mean, that was his background. He came up through the ranks. He knew what he was doing. He knew how to deal with an emergency, and did. So Congress passes this bill. They have the debate on it. The Republicans, the Democrats, they all get out. They all talk about it. Everybody has, you know, huff and puff. But, you know, really, ultimately, even the Republicans. Yes, I realize it's shocking. Even the Republicans ultimately agreed, or at least enough of them that they got a majority of votes, you know, that they could get the thing passed through the House and the Senate. It would have taken, what, about 16, 17 of them in the House of Representatives, depending on how many, you know, maybe a few more if there were some Democratic defections, and it would have taken 6 or 7 of them in the Senate, Republicans, who agreed with the Democrats that, you know, this is a good idea, that if you're going to have somebody running FEMA, keep in mind, 1,800 people died in New Orleans, and they are still finding bodies. If you're going to have somebody run FEMA, an agency that probably more than most is directly responsible for the life and survival of Americans, you want that person to have knowledge of what FEMA is all about, which is the Federal Emergency Management Agency. That they have a knowledge in and demonstrated ability in and knowledge of emergency management, and that they know how to run a big agency. Not less than 5 years of executive leadership. So this gets passed by the House. It gets passed by the Senate. Now, prior to Bush, any president who got a piece of legislation like this, who disagreed with it, would say, I'm not going to sign this, which is called a pocket veto. And Congress can override that, or would simply say, I'm going to veto this, and would issue a veto statement about why he wasn't signing it, or perhaps someday she wasn't signing it. And then Congress would have to muster two-thirds vote to push it over the objections of the president. But Bush went ahead, George W. Bush went ahead and signed this piece of legislation. You would think that's the law now, right? That if a new director of FEMA is appointed, that director must have 5 years' experience as an executive, as a senior executive, know how to run a major agency, and have demonstrated ability in and knowledge of emergency management. You would think that that's the law. George Bush signed the law. 2 hours after he signed it, he issued a signing statement, this little gift that Sam Alito brought us. Yes, it was Sam Alito's idea back 20 years ago that presidents should have signing statements as ways of clarifying that they're the ones who have final say in all things. 2 hours after he signed the bill, George W. Bush issued a signing statement saying that he could ignore the law. That if he appointed somebody to be the director of FEMA, they did not have to have executive qualifications, and they did not have to have emergency management experience. That he could simply ignore the law. That was his right. He has done this more than 750 times. Now, you tell me this is not imperious Rex. This is not aristocracy run amok. I mean, one of the biggest problems, frankly, in my opinion, of the Bush administration is that this guy, born a multimillionaire, believes that he is entitled to everything that he's gotten throughout his life. All of the bailouts he's gotten, from his daddy bailing him out when he got busted for cocaine, to his daddy bailing him out when he got busted for insider trading, to his daddy bailing him out when he got busted for drunk driving, to Osama bin Laden's half-brother bailing him out when his company went south, to, I mean, just the list goes on and on and on. He just, you know, is this feeling of entitlement, this sense of royalty, this boy king. And that the Republican Party, which has historically been, frankly, more wary of executive power than the Democratic Party, it's the Republican Party that has always argued, or has historically argued, at least since the 1870s, that we should have a weak federal government. They want to take us back to pre-Civil War days. Weak federal government, strong states. You know, after the Civil War, there was a significant transformation, in part because of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, and in part because of the reorganization of government under Abraham Lincoln. But the foundational, there was a sea change that happened as a consequence of the Civil War. Before the Civil War, we had a weak federal government and strong states. Since the Civil War, we've had a strong federal government and relatively weak states. And the Republicans, since the 1870s, have tried to reverse that in some regards. I mean, now they want a strong federal government when it comes to things like subsidies for oil companies or subsidies for corn growers who are going to make corn syrup so that the candy industry can get cheap sweeteners and all the rest of America can get obesity. They like a strong federal government when it comes to that kind of thing. But they want a weak federal government when it comes to things like enforcing the Voting Rights Act or Social Security, offering Social Security, or having a national minimum wage. They think that all these things are wrong. Any kind of federal support of unemployment insurance. I mean, you can just go right on down the list of all the progressive reforms, essentially, that the Republicans have opposed. Fundamentally, I mean, you know, at their core, what they're all about is rolling back the New Deal. I mean, I've said this over and over again. I don't think I can say it enough times. That
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
As Mr. Limbaugh says. But that's really what they're all about. And they're not ashamed of it at all, by the way. And I find it so strange that the party that historically has said, no, the federal government has too much power, would not just allow, but would encourage, would support a boy king type of personality in aggregating this massive amount of power in the presidency, when there's a chance that the Republicans might lose the presidency and they could end up on the receiving end of the very power that they've historically feared. I mean, all we need to say to them is, hey, you know, Hillary Clinton might be president. Do you really want that much power concentrated in the hands of the president? I would think Republicans would run from that. Time now for today's progressive pop quiz. Nancy Pelosi says she will do what when the Democrats take back the House of Representatives? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 1-866-440-THOM 440-8466 gets an autographed copy of Screwed.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Past the hour, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, the Tom Hartman radio program. Well, total world domination. Yeah, we'd settle for a clean election. We really would. In our progressive pop quiz today, our question was, Nancy Pelosi says she will do what when the Democrats take back the House of Representatives? And congratulations to Court Vall in Seattle, Washington. There you go. Court knew that the correct answer is implementing the recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, or draining the GOP swamp, or putting new rules in place to break the link between lobbyists and legislation. Basically, those are the things she said she was going to do in her first 3 days as Speaker. And God bless her for it. And congratulations to Court. Court wins a copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, autographed by me.
Get Screwed by Tom Hartman.
Yes, thank you, Alex. Nancy Pelosi also said that in the first 100 hours, what is that, 4 days, something like that, more or less, 4 days and 4 hours. In the first 100 hours, she's going to raise the minimum wage, the federal minimum wage, to $7.25 an hour, maybe in one step. Going to cut interest rates on student loans in half. She's going to allow the government to negotiate directly with pharmaceutical companies to lower the drug costs of Medicare. She's going to broaden the types of stem cell research allowed with federal funds. She told the Associated Press, "I hope to have a veto-proof majority." After that, pay as you go. No more increasing the deficit, whether the issue is middle-class tax relief, health care, or some other priority. To do that, she said, the Bush-era tax cuts would be rolled back for those with above a certain level. She mentioned annual incomes of $250,000 to $300,000 a year and higher, and said tax rates for those individuals might revert to those of the Clinton era. Details will have to be worked out, she emphasized. In other words, she's going to give us the taxes that Bill Clinton gave us, and in all probability, it'll bring us the economy Bill Clinton brought us, which wasn't so bad. You know, we developed a surplus, arguably the edge of a surplus in any case. So it was a good start. It is Friday, by the way. If any topic you want to call on, actually any day of the week, any kind of topic you want to call on, we'll pick it up and run with it. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. James in New Paltz, New York. Hey, James.
Hey, how you been, Tom? I'm sorry I missed your book signing in Brooklyn. I hope you come back to the Hudson Valley or New York soon.
Well, I hope to. We don't have specific plans to, but you just never know.
Okay. One thing I'd like to talk about, a very interesting thing in today's Times. Actually, it was on the front page on the website. The Christian right is very concerned right now that they're losing their youth members in droves, and they claim by the next generation only 3% of Americans will classify themselves as evangelical Christians.
Right. Yeah, Laura Goodstein's article, Evangelicals Fear the Loss of Their Teenagers.
And I think this coincides with a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about that Congressman Sanders brought up. I mean, are you familiar with the Thomas Frank book, What's the Matter with Kansas?
I am, yeah. And he's been on this program.
Oh, I'm sorry. Anyhow,
it was 2 years ago when the book came out.
Okay. But the point is that there's a certain percentage of this country, you can't talk about economic issues, you can't talk about the screwing of the middle class. All these people seem to care about is abortion and gay rights. And, you know, I don't know what it is, but this seems to be their precedent. This is what concerns them, and everything else be damned. You know, they feel they have some personal relationship with God and Armageddon is coming. And please, I don't want to challenge or question anyone's religious beliefs, but I don't like closed minds. I don't like this kind of narrow-mindedness.
Well, the problem is when religion becomes public policy.
Mm-hmm.
I can certainly separate whatever my religious beliefs are from what I think would be good public policy. I mean, on the other hand, there are those who can't. James Watt, for example, I write about this in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, when he was asked why he was selling off Western lands to mining interests, foreign mining interests at that, Canadian mining companies,
mm-hmm.
for pennies on the dollar. And they were coming in and just raping the land, and mostly gold mining, and leaving arsenic behind, because you use arsenic to separate the gold out, and polluting the rivers and all this kind of stuff, and leaving wastelands. His response was, "Jesus is coming one day soon, and he will make all things new." That's a verbatim quote. And that, I'm sorry, is not public policy. That's, you can believe that in your church, but you don't make public policy for the United States. You're supposed to represent all the people of the United States, not just those who are believers in the rapture.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, I'm with you there on that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Have a good day.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks, James. Well, the larger issue is this thing about, in the New York Times, they're talking about how in the generation of World War II, my father's generation, 65% of their kids, 65% of the Bible-thumping Christians, in quotes, this is from the New York Times, of basically fundamentalist Christian believers, 65% of their children became fundamentalist believers. And the baby boomers, my generation, the people who are in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, about 35% of their children, if they are fundamentalists, are becoming fundamentalists. But they're projecting, and I think this is just hysteria. I think these are scare tactics that the right is using to scare its own people, because they're very good at using fear to motivate people. And what they're saying is that the people who are, the kids who are in their 20s now and early 30s, that generation, that the probability of their children among the evangelicals in that group, the probability of their children being evangelicals is only 4%. And they're calling this the 4% panic attack. And, like I said, I think this is just, wildly blown out of proportion. But there's 6,000 pastors and leadership meetings in 44 cities across the country. They've always got to have an enemy, They've always got to have somebody to be afraid of. Be afraid. Be very afraid. It's a shame. 27 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Did my ballot go? Lost my faith in the government when they changed the rules without my consent. Don't wanna be nobody's experiment. Didn't wanna know where my ballot went. They lost my vote. I made my choice. Does anybody care to hear my voice? They lost my vote. Was that the man? Nobody knows that I took a stand.
Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change in America. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. By the way, announcing our October surprise contest on the Tom Hartman program message blogs. The first person to post the correct answer to what's the Bush administration's October surprise over on our message board. Don't email it to me. You can drop into our chat room, but that's not where we're taking the entries. This is over on the message board. The first person to post the correct answer to what's the Bush administration's October surprise gets an autographed copy of my book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The day after the election, we'll be putting up a poll in the message board so that our members can vote on a winner and four runners-up, and each of those five people will receive an autographed copy of Screwed. We'll announce the winner on November 13th. So there you go. Be there or be square, as they say. The outrage of the day, in my mind, I mean, this signing statement that Bush just did with this Homeland Security bill is incredible. But it's just one of many. I mean, it's just one of many outrages. Here we have Senator John Warner. This is not an outrage. This is just kind of an amazing thing. Senator John Warner just came back from a week in Iraq. The Republican from Virginia. And what did he say? This is a stay the course guy. This is a I'm with George guy. He said, quote, in 2 or 3 months, if this thing hasn't come to fruition and if this level of violence is not under control and this government able to function, I think it's a responsibility of our government internally to determine is there a change of course that we should take, end quote. Now, the good news is you have a Republican saying, hey, we need to think maybe that we should change course in Iraq. The bad news is he's saying, I'm really not going to say this until after the elections. So, you know, he's being John Warner. He's being a Republican. Meanwhile, John Ashcroft, who will be on this program either next week or the week after, we have him booked, assuming he doesn't bail out on us. He has a new book out, Never Again, and he's out there flogging it. And he's launched an attack on the 9/11 Commission. He says they're seemingly obsessed with trying to lay the blame for the terrorist attack at the feet of the Bush administration while virtually absolving the previous administration of responsibility. Yeah. Might this have something to do with the fact that on 7/10, on July 10th, 7/10, that the CIA sought a special meeting with Condoleezza Rice, who then asked them to go to John Ashcroft and present the same information, which they did, where they came in with a PowerPoint presentation and said on a scale of 1 to 10, the probability of a serious terrorist attack inside the United States by Osama bin Laden is a 10, and we need to do something right now. You guys need to be drilling down into the information that the FBI and the CIA have and find out where they are, track them down, and Condoleezza Rice blew them off and said, no, we're interested in missile defense. I'm going to give a speech. In fact, I've got a really important speech scheduled for the 11th of September on missile defense. We're going to restart the Star Wars program. There's $1 trillion out there of government money that we need to give to contractors who are in bed with the Republicans. And she sent them packing. And they went to Ashcroft and they said, you know, Attorney General Ashcroft, you know, you need to alert all the FBI offices that there's these terrorists who are associated with Osama bin Laden and the Wahhabists out of Saudi Arabia and the jihadists out of Afghanistan. Find out, ask your field offices, do they know anything? And John Ashcroft could have very easily simply sent out a memo that would have caused somebody in the Midwest to say, hey, we've got this woman, Colleen Rowley, working here for the FBI, and she says that she's got this guy, Zacharias Massawi, who's trying to learn how to fly an airplane but doesn't care that he doesn't know how to land or take off. They might have tracked down the FBI offices in the Pacific Southwest. I believe it was out of Phoenix. A similar thing. They might have learned about the weird things going on in Florida in the flight schools. They might have talked to the FBI agent who was a roommate in California with two of the hijackers. But no, John Ashcroft didn't do any of that. He simply stopped flying on commercial aircraft. So now he's running around going, this is just a smear job. But here's in State of Denial, this is from the Center for American Progress. In State of Denial, Bob Woodward writes that Condoleezza Rice received a briefing on 7/10/2001, July 10, 2001, quote, showing the increasing likelihood that al-Qaeda would soon attack the U.S. According to the State Department, on July 17, 2001, Ashcroft received the same CIA briefing about an imminent al-Qaeda strike on an American target. Despite the accumulating evidence that he failed to act on these pre-9/11 warnings, Ashcroft told NBC's News' Today show earlier this week he had never received any evidence of a domestic threat. He says, I'm surprised they wouldn't have had such a briefing for the Attorney General. NBC, you never heard of a domestic threat? Ashcroft, well, there was talk of threats, kind we'd endured before, but when asked about is there any evidence that the threat would be domestic, the answer simply was no. Well, then, why did you stop flying on commercial aircraft in July of 2001? Thomas Pickard, the former acting director of the FBI, told the 9/11 Commission that when he tried to talk to Ashcroft about domestic terrorism threats, Ashcroft said, I don't want to hear about that stuff. It's a verbatim quote. I don't want to hear about that stuff. And now you've got Slade Gordon. He's a Republican who was on the 9/11 Commission. A Republican on the 9/11 Commission, who said that Ashcroft, quote, may very well have been the worst witness we interviewed because he was very unresponsive and unhelpful. What are these guys covering up? Is it incompetence? Or is it that they wanted a Pearl Harbor event? You'll recall George W. Bush on 9/11 dictated into his diary. I mean, he doesn't write diaries. He doesn't. I'm not going to make a literacy joke here, but he dictates his diary, and you know the White House secretaries transcribe it. And on 9/11, what he dictated was, today we had a Pearl Harbor event. Virtually the same language you find in the Project for New American Centuries. You know, we need a Pearl Harbor event in order to galvanize America. 1-866-440-8466. Jay in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind today?
Hey, first of all, we all need to keep underscoring the point that despite everything you just mentioned, they reacted to the news of the first crash as if it was an accident. The World Trade Center, number one terrorist target without a cloud in the sky. What the hell?
Yeah, an hour and a half after four planes, they realized the four planes had been hijacked.
Yeah, I mean, I realize.
This is nuts. This is impossible.
Yeah, exactly.
This is impossible. And then Bush just, you know, kind of making up this story about how, well, yeah, I saw that thing, and I thought, boy, this guy is just the world's worst pilot, you know. It's,
Jordan, you're not going to believe what state I was in when I heard about the terrorist attack. I was in Florida. And my chief of staff, Andy Card, well, actually, I was in a classroom talking about a reading program that works. And I was sitting outside the classroom waiting to go in, and I saw an airplane hit the tower TV was obviously on, and I used to fly myself, and I said, well, there's one terrible pilot. And said it must have been a horrible accident. But I was whisked off there. I didn't have much time to think about it. I was sitting in the classroom, and Andy Card, my chief of staff, was sitting over here, walked in and said, a second plane has hit the tower. America's under attack.
Now, here's the weird gotcha in all that. And nobody in America saw the first plane hit the first tower until about 28 hours later when I believe it was a French tourist's videotape was sold to one of the news media outlets because nobody had a camera trained on the Twin Towers until after the first strike. So what we all see in all the videos is the second strike. So, you know, is he just making that up? I think he is. I think he's a pathological liar. But there are some people who think that, you know, he was watching to see it happen. I don't, you know, who knows?
No. The point is, when there's a lie, there must be something duplicitous going on.
Yeah. Well said.
My on Charlie Rose a few nights ago, Bob Woodward was on talking for an hour about his book, and they covered this stuff about Bush not consulting with his father about invading Iraq.
Right.
Like you would think, not because he's your father, but he was the last president who dealt with this. It's kind of obvious, you would think. And Rose pressed the point, like, are you sure he didn't? I mean, you phrased it and you repressed the question. It's like, yeah, I made it clear. And Rose actually said, that's incomprehensible. What's so bizarre about that conversation was the two of them had the exact same conversation 2 or 3 years ago, and Rose said, that's incomprehensible. And neither one of them said, wait a minute, we had this conversation 2 years ago, and nobody bothered to say, well, gee, maybe such a person shouldn't be reelected.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wouldn't fault Charlie Rose for saying, you know, as we said 3 years ago, because you get a lot of new listeners in the 3 years, and they're hearing it for the first time. So they're just, you know, he's just going through it for the newbies. But, the fact that George W. Bush chose not to consult his father, who was the last guy to have a war with Saddam Hussein before he started a war with Saddam Hussein, is incomprehensible. It's mind-boggling.
Do me a favor and check out a Yahoo group called Undo Bush.
Undo Bush. Okay, Yahoo group. Yeah. Thanks a lot, Jay. Good to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour on the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where smart people get their news.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your ears. The president kicked democracy out the door and he shipped it off to a foreign show. Giving birth instead to a holy war. So sore, we only killed 100,000 or more. It's all collateral damage when you're waging a war. Bringing democracy back to the USA, 'cause it's slipping further and further away. And remember, democracy starts with you.
Tag your ears.
9 minutes before the hour, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Tonight at 7:30, I'll be at Town Hall. You can pick up tickets. They're $5. That just basically goes to pay for the rental of Town Hall. This is a book signing, basically, put on by Elliott Bay Book Company. I'll be talking on the topic of Screwed, the undeclared war against the American middle class and what we can do about it. Town Hall is located at 8th at Seneca in Seattle. And that'll be at 7:30 tonight. Tomorrow at 1 p.m., I'll be at the University of Washington Young Democrats meeting, and Congressman Jim McDermott says he's going to drop in and say hello, and we'll be doing a book signing and a talk on the same topic. That's at the university's district store. It's sponsored by UW Young Democrats. And tomorrow night, Saturday night, October 7th, I will be at, from 6 to 8 p.m., the keynote speaker at the annual dinner for the Physicians for Social Responsibility in Washington State. WPSR.org is their website. So check it out. All of that's over at TomHartman.com on my schedule if you're curious or if you're interested, if you happen to be in that neck of the woods. 52 minutes past the hour. I'm going to go back to your phone calls here. I just want to play two pieces of audio that just stand alone. This is Laura Logan, the reporter for CBS News. On the CBS, I believe it was the CBS Evening News yesterday.
Well, we're
We were asked not to quote directly, but the facts of the report are that hospitals have become command and control centers for the Mehdi Army militia. Sunni patients are being murdered, some dragged from their beds. The militia is keeping hostages inside some hospitals, where they're tortured and executed.
Grim news. Very grim news. And then, you know, what are we doing about this? Here's Michael Ware on CNN talking about, and you know, Condoleezza Rice is visiting Iraq right now, right, to see how wonderful everything is.
Does she really see what's happening inside Iraq? Does she leave there with a better appreciation of either the sectarian violence or the insurgency?
Of course not, Wolf. I mean, you can just imagine the umbrella of security that encases someone like the Secretary of State. But I mean, going from the airport, which is its own self-contained little bubble, to the Green Zone, which is the ultimate bubble here in Iraq, I mean, U.S. officials and contractors and all manner of people will come and do 6 to 12 months in Iraq, but never leave the Green Zone. They don't know even what it's like to walk an Iraqi street. Certainly not without the shroud of heavily armed American soldiers about them. They don't know what it's like to go to someone's home and just sit and talk with them, to shop in the markets, to have blackouts, to not have water, to have to queue for benzene. Secretary Rice is so far divorced from that reality that she couldn't possibly hope to understand it, certainly not from fleeting visits to an artificial bubble like the Green Zone.
There you go, Michael Ware on CNN, on Wolf Blitzer's Situation Room. 1-866-440-8466. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Tom.
Hey, I want to talk quickly about Andy Stern because it might help you in your tour this weekend.
Sure. The president of SEIU?
Exactly. Real quick, though, did you see Olbermann's special commentary last night?
I did not.
Got to see it. He talks about Bush's pathological lying. It's great.
Hopefully it's like on YouTube or something, because I was at one of the World Can't Wait things yesterday afternoon, and then I did a book signing last night, and so my...
Yeah, he's becoming Edward R. Murrow, right?
I think that's, yeah, Edward R. Murrow is clearly his hero and role model.
Right. Go to crooksandliars.com. They have it up.
Oh, great. Okay, we'll track it down.
But Andy Stern was on NPR today. You know, he's the head of the largest labor union, and I'm telling you...
The fastest-growing labor union in the United States, too, by the way.
Okay. But there's some problems. It's much bigger than you think, man. This guy, I think he's a Republican mole, a double agent.
Andy Stern?
But he said, get ready, these are several shocking statements that he said, and I called in to challenge him. He said, Thomas Friedman is right. The world is flat. He said, we need to stop looking backwards to FDR's New Deal. It's a new century, so stop harping on the New Deal. Taft-Hartley was passed under a Democratic president. When he said that, when I challenged him, I was cut off. I wanted to remind him it was over Truman's veto that GOP Congress passed it, but they cut me off, so I couldn't get that in. So can you believe this?
That's really strange.
I said, hey, I disagree with you on looking back to the New Deal, because we all know the Republican Party is all about dismantling the New Deal. What do you mean don't talk about it? He said, well, it's not just the Republicans, it's the Democrats too. And that's when he went into the Taft-Hartley thing, saying it was passed under a Democratic president. And I'm thinking, this guy must be like these Republicans that vote, guys in the union that vote Republican, appease your oppressor.
Right.
And this guy leads now the head of the biggest union in the USA.
That's pretty amazing.
I'm going to send you the audio clip so you can, back it up, right?
Yeah. We had Andy Stern scheduled to be a guest here on the program about 6 or 8 months ago, and he canceled.
Yeah, this guy, I'm telling you, he's like that Tomlinson that infiltrated PBS. I mean, it is weird.
Amazing. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because this morning on my local show, I interviewed the head of SEIU here in Oregon, Leslie Frain, and she, I guarantee you, is no Republican in sheep's clothing. But, we'll have to check this out. Tom, thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it. It's always good to hear from you. 57, and thanks for listening to us there in Minneapolis. 57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. We'll be back with your calls and more news right after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, it's finally happened. A public school teacher was arrested today at John F. Kennedy International Airport. Welcome back to the program, by the way. Tom Hartman here. As he attempted to board a flight while in possession of a ruler, a protractor, a set square, a slide rule, and a calculator. At a morning press conference, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez said he believes the man is a member of the notorious Al Jabra movement. He did not identify the man who had been charged by the FBI with carrying weapons of math instruction. Algebra is a problem for us, Gonzalez said. They desire solutions by means and extremes. Sometimes go off on tangents in search of absolute value. They use secret code names like X and Y to refer to themselves as unknowns. But we have determined that they belong to a common denominator of the axis of medieval, with coordinates in every country. As the Greek philanderer Isosceles used to say, there are three sides to every triangle. When asked to comment on the arrest, President Bush said, if God had wanted us to have better weapons of math instruction, he would have given us more fingers and toes. White House aides told reporters they could not recall a more intelligent or profound statement by the president. Thank you to Diane, who forwarded that to me from source unknown. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Well, weapons of math instruction, Victoria?
Oh, yes, indeed. Yes, weapons that were always way beyond my reach or understanding, I have to tell you.
Indeed.
And algebra, of course, is in fact Arabic, is it not?
It is. In fact, yeah. The zero was Arabic. That was a massive contribution to the ability to understand science in the world was the invention of the zero, which came out of Arabic Muslim, you know, early culture. Yeah.
Amazing.
So go figure. So what's happening in Washington, D.C.?
Well, big reaction, really, to the statements by the Republican chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Senator John Warner.
On his return from Iraq.
Right, his return from a one-day trip to Iraq, where he basically said that Iraq is drifting sideways. Deputy Press Secretary Dana Perino was asked to comment on that today, and she wouldn't characterize the president as viewing Iraq in any way as drifting sideways. In fact, they continue to insist that progress is being made in Iraq. However, she was asked in the early morning gaggle by Helen Thomas whether Secretary Rice has blinders on, if she in fact views us as making progress in Iraq with as many deaths as we've had this week. And Ms. Perino was quite offended by that comment.
Interesting. Now, I'm also interested in the fact that John Ashcroft is now coming out huffing and puffing about the fact that he was notified on July 17th.
Yes.
That on a scale of 1 to 10, the probability of an attack inside the United States by al-Qaeda was a 10. He did nothing about it. He didn't send out a memo to everybody saying, hey, is Colleen Rowley out there? You know, is there anybody out there who knows anything about this? Because he would have immediately been able to stop 9/11. He did nothing. And, in fact, he told a subordinate that he didn't want to hear about that domestic terrorism stuff. And now he's attacking the 9/11 Commission for trying to lay the blame for 9/11 on the Bush administration.
Right, exactly. And one intrepid member of the press corps asked Dana Perino about that.
Nope, we lost. See, this is what happens when you talk about John Ashcroft. There goes Victoria. Off she went. She's not even on the board anymore. She's just totally vanished. Hopefully she'll call back and we'll find out what happened. It reminds me of that joke. You know, President Bush comes to visit a classroom and says, I'll take any questions you want. And one of the kids raises his hand and says, Mr. Bush, a couple of questions here. What are you going to do about Social Security and what about those people in Guantanamo and why'd you let 9/11 happen? And Bush says, well, it's a really interesting, three really interesting questions. And just then the bell goes off. And so the kids all have to leave. And they come back 15 minutes after recess. And another kid raises his hand. Bush is there and raises his hand. And says, I have four questions.
And Bush says, okay. And he says, there are five questions. He says, Bush says, okay. He says, what's the deal with Guantanamo? And what about Social Security? And what about Iraq? And most importantly, what happened, you know, why did the bell go off 10 minutes earlier? And what happened to Stanley, the kid who was asking the questions before? So here we are. And Stanley is back. Victoria Jones is back with us. Okay. An intrepid reporter dared ask about John Ashcroft.
I did ask about John Ashcroft and about the
this
other
is you who did?
I did.
You're the intrepid reporter.
I was the intrepid
reporter. I should have known.
Yes.
Okay. And
And about him saying that the hearings were not so much about discovering the truth as they were about assessing blame and grandstanding. All she would say was that neither the president nor she had seen the book. And so consequently, she had absolutely nothing that she could say about it.
Which book? Woodward's book
Ashcroft,
or Ashcroft's book?
Ashcroft's book. So she couldn't say anything because she had not seen Ashcroft's book.
Yeah, interesting. But he's
out. So it was a non-answer.
Yeah, and this is something not that he said in his book. This is something that he said in the press. I mean, this was in an interview that he was doing with let's see who it was. It was on NBC's Today Show. He said, if there had been such a meeting, he's talking about the seven. What turned out to be on July 17th, he was officially briefed, and we now have confirmation of that. He received the exact same CIA briefing that Condi Rice did. He said, if there had been such a meeting that had taken place with Ms. Rice, and she had been told there was a domestic threat, that was the feature of the meeting. I'm surprised they wouldn't have had such a briefing for the Attorney General as well. NBC says, you never heard of a domestic threat impending? Ashcroft, there was a lot of talk of threats, the kind we had endured before, but when asked about whether there is any evidence that the threat would be domestic, the answer simply was no. End of quote. But then you have former acting director of the FBI, Thomas Pickard, who testified to the 9/11 commission that Ashcroft, quote, didn't want to hear about domestic terrorism threats, end quote. And now Slate Gordon, the Republican from, I think he's from New Hampshire, as I recall. Slate Gordon has come, no, he's from
Washington State.
Washington State. Oh, that's it. Thank you, Heidi. And thank you, Victoria. Slate Gordon comes out and he says that Ashcroft, quote, may well have been the very worst witness we interviewed before the 9/11 commission because he was very unresponsive and unhelpful, end quote. And you have to ask the question, these guys can't be that dumb. What are they covering up?
I don't know what they're covering up. I mean, if I knew what they were covering up, I'd be talking about it.
Yeah, it's
amazing. But you do start to get the impression that there has to be something.
There's something major, and I don't think that they're covering up incompetence, although it's I suppose it's conceivable. Condi Rice was scheduled on 9/11 to give a major speech on Star Wars. We know that Bush had this mentality that anything Clinton did, he shouldn't do, that he needed to set off in a new direction. And Clinton was obsessed with Al-Qaeda and obsessed with getting bin Laden. And that would be the last thing that Bush would want to do. I mean, his father was having breakfast with bin Laden's half-brother on 9/11, on the morning of 9/11. Bush's business was bailed out by another half-brother of Osama bin Laden, Salman bin Laden, who later mysteriously died, well, not mysteriously, but later died in a small plane crash in Texas. You can understand, I suppose, why he wouldn't want to investigate the bin Laden family, but just shutting down the investigations of Saudis and all this kind of stuff. I find the timing of this whole meltdown with Foley actually to be very convenient for the Bush administration. Am I starting to sound like a conspiracy nut here, Victoria?
Yes, you are. But that doesn't mean to say that you're not right.
Yeah.
But the only reason you're sounding like a conspiracy theorist is because you're the only person that I'm hearing say this.
Well, I'm hearing a lot of my callers are saying to me that they're of the opinion that Karl Rove, in order to deflect attention away from the discussion that Bob Woodward started about 7/10, that Karl Rove was willing to throw Mark Foley to the wolves and just didn't expect that it would blow back on Denny Hastert and whatnot. But they still have 4 weeks until the election. I mean, which is an amazing amount of time in the political cycle. They have plenty of time to clean this thing up.
But do they really think that Karl Rove wouldn't have foreseen that?
That's a good question, and that's the part that gives me pause on that particular conspiracy theory. You know, I think it's probably more likely that the thing just played out when it played out because it was something waiting to play out. But then the question is, how do they now? What they're doing is they're gaggling about how or getting together trying to figure out how they can make the best of it. How can they blame it on a gay conspiracy or something? Or how can they even use it to make America more hysterical about gays? Even though this has nothing to do with being gay, this has to do with pedophilia. So.
Well, I find it fascinating how Rush Limbaugh is now trying to blame it on the boys.
Oh yeah, this is obscene, Limbaugh.
Maybe the page. My original theory. Maybe the page is out there engaged in some kind of chicanery. Maybe the page. You know, kids play pranks too.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, this is a prank. Yeah.
Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria, for sharing your day with us. And
thank you. And
for calling back. It's always wonderful to hear from you.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the radio support group of, by, and for We the People. We'll be back with your calls right after this break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The fact is that they tell you lies. Things get different names. Like oil becomes democracy. The fact is that they tell you lies. Debt gets different names. Like collateral damage. The fact is that the dead, they all had different plans. They all had names and faces, hopes and dreams. The fact is, war solves nothing, makes a lot of people dead, and a few rich people happy. Stop the war!
Stop the war! Stop the war!
Stop the war!
Welcome back to the Pillow. I'll help you escape the Matrix. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour, 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM. Nina in Sacramento, California, KSAC. Hey, Nina.
Hello.
Hi.
Hey, I've been waiting a long time.
Well, you are live and here. Thank you for waiting. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. First thing I have to tell you is that I tried to call in, and it sounds like you're saying 840. And I called the 840 number, and a lady's getting a lot of calls.
Oh, really?
And she actually gave me the right phone number.
Oh, my.
She said, could you please say 440?
I'll have to be more articulate in the future, yes. 1-866-440-8466, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And so the thing I wanted to talk about was Bush. I think that we need to stop putting it out there that he's incompetent, because I don't think he's incompetent at all. I think he uses that because if you're incompetent, if you're a buffoon, people forgive you. They look over it.
Yeah.
Because there's too many things that have been done in this country, too many injustices since he's been in office that have to be strategically planned. There's no way it could just be a Forrest Gump moment every time happens.
You know, Nina, I, by and large, I agree with you. However, let's just posit one thing here for a second. Do you need to run and catch that phone?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Let's assume for a moment that it's true that George Bush actually is one of those true believers in the so-called free market, and that he, you know, agrees with Reagan's assessment that, you know, government is a terrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Reagan's famous statement, here he is.
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And therefore, because of this irrational religion of the free market, George Bush actually believed that if he simply let the Red Cross and Pat Robertson's Operation Blessing and the free market solve the problem of the Hurricane Katrina, that it would get solved. And that if he, and similarly in Iraq, if they simply let the contractors in there and let the corporations in there and let them run free, that it would solve the problem and everything would be fine, and they would be able to prove that the free market works. Now, if that's why they did those things, if it wasn't some Machiavellian plan, and because I frankly have a hard time thinking that he really wants us to be bogged down in Iraq like this long, you know, no matter how much money they're giving to the contractors, they could figure out other ways to give it to them without having, you know, 2,700 Americans die. If that's the case, then that belief has led to a profound level of incompetence. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does.
And so I think that their incompetence is a consequence of their irrational religion of the free market.
And that's what I'm talking about, that they put in things in place, and then you get a certain outcome, and then everybody says, oh, he's stupid, oh, he doesn't know, he can't. I don't think it's that at all. I think that, like you said, you go in with a certain belief system, but you're not prepared for the outcome.
Right.
Or you expect a different outcome.
Yeah, so what this is demonstrating is not competence or incompetence. What it's demonstrating is the failure of their belief system in how government can never do anything right and private industry always does everything right.
Yeah.
Okay. All righty. It's a fine point, a subtle point, let's say. And I suspect that probably, you know, like Bernie Sanders earlier, you know, he was saying, well, these guys are incompetent. And I was saying to him what you were just saying to me. I think actually they've been very competent in some regard. I mean, you know, they look at the tax cuts they got passed, and now we've got two levels of taxation, you know, 15% maximum income tax for people who earn their living sitting around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
They've been very competent at some of these things. But I think that politically, it's probably a reasonable strategy, for lack of a better word, to keep that meme out there that they're incompetent, because it will cause people more readily to dismiss them. You don't have to educate Joe Sixpack about the difference in worldview between Bush and the rest of, you know, average Americans who actually believe that government can do something useful, who look at the fire department and say, hey, you know, they do a good job of putting out fires. We would like to keep them. We don't want to privatize them. And so without having to go through that whole educational process, it's easier to just say, well, these guys are incompetent, and people vote them out, and the effect is the same.
Yeah. Or they forgive them and let them stay.
Well, that's the problem. There's
still elections. I don't know which one.
That's the problem. And that's where I don't disagree with you. That I think that we use the word incompetent at our peril, and it's probably one of the few areas where I have even some small disagreement with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I think so, because there's things, and then not only that, but once, hello?
Yeah, if you wrap it up quickly, Nina.
Okay. Once something does happen, then we don't expect a different change. We don't expect an outcome change, because they don't go back and fix it. They just keep moving on to the next thing.
That's right. That's right.
Because he's incompetent, he can't even fix it.
That's right. And disaster after disaster, we need to point out that they're coming out of a philosophy. Nina, thank you very much for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The hour tonight, 7:30 p.m., Elliott Bay Book Company presenting me at Town Hall in Seattle. $5 are the tickets. That's to pay for the rental of Town Hall. That's where we're going to be. It's at the corner of 8th and Seneca at 7:30 p.m. Be there, be square. Tomorrow at 1 o'clock, I'll be at the Young Democrats of University of Washington at the University District Store, doing a reading and book signing at 1 o'clock. And Congressman Jim McDermott said he may drop by and say hello. And at 6 o'clock tomorrow night, I'm keynoting the Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility annual dinner. So, and there's more information over at tomhartman.com. Just, you know, click on our schedule. Well, here's the ultimate irony. They have discovered a drug. Here's the good news. They have discovered a drug that prevents acetylcholine from breaking down in the brain and forming the plaques, these clumps of protein that kill off the brain in Alzheimer's. In other words, that essentially stops Alzheimer's in its tracks. They found a drug that is more potent at doing this than any of the commercially marketed drugs. That's the good news. The bad news is the drug that does this is known as Delta-9-tetrahydrocannabinol, or THC,
otherwise known as the active ingredient in marijuana. Fascinating. Long ago and far away, a number of people actually have hypothesized over the years that we co-evolved with the plant kingdom. They wonder why there are receptors in the brain for THC. And in all probability, it's because the human species has interacted with that plant for hundreds of thousands of years. And it turns out that the plant may be very, very medicinal. I mean, they're already using it for Lou Gehrig's disease, I believe. I know that they're using it for cancer, glaucoma, and to help reduce the side effects from cancer and AIDS treatments and I believe MS. I may be wrong on that, but there's a number of conditions that THC has been found, or pot, otherwise known, has been found useful for. When is the government going to stop this insane criminalization of a plant that grows wild, used to grow wild all over this country? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, and Andy in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andy, thanks for listening to WPTT. What's up?
Hi, Mr. Hartman.
Hi.
It's an honor to talk to you. You're the light end of that very long, dark tunnel we're in.
Well, we are the light, Andy. We just have to wake ourselves up.
Exactly. And as just an aside, I guess I'm probably not going to have to worry about Alzheimer's.
Good. I salute you.
Last Friday, or actually it was Thursday, when Congress passed the Habeas Corpus bill.
Yeah.
It really set me off. I had a horrible day Friday and not so hot through the weekend. And I don't know whether it was Monday or Tuesday, but you mentioned kind of like a formula where every 30 years or so the conservative movement implodes.
Yeah.
I just finished What Would Jefferson Do? Mm-hmm. I read We the People already. I guess I'm going backwards. So I've just started reading Ancient Sunlight.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm gathering bits and pieces. It's very, very informative. But what I was telling your screener was what we need is a Reader's Digest condensed version of American political history.
Well, I think what We the People is. It's a 132-page comic book that actually is...
Which I read that, and it's very, very good. But it as far as I didn't know about the cycle...
That's something that frankly, I've only learned about in the last year. So it's not in any of my books. But
it
will be in the future.
An extended pamphlet, 20, 30, 40 pages of just a skeletal.
Well, as I learn these things, Andy, I write op-eds about them, and this most recent one, will be showing up soon. Go to TomHartmann.com and click articles on democracy, and there's a chronological from the most recent to the most ancient of my writings in the political field on that page. I agree. Particularly the intrinsic instability of laissez-faire conservatism and how it always implodes and historically has. It's a micro version of the macro that pretty much everyone is aware of how empires implode.
Yeah, exactly.
And they rise up and then they reach a certain point where it's sort of the Peter principle. They rise to the level of their own incompetence. Or in this case, they rise to the level of their own inability to maintain themselves, and then they implode, usually in very messy fashions.
If we could get that across to the other side and see what happened in the 1850s, and this is what happened in the 1890s, and this is what happened in the 20s.
Yeah.
It's like, duh.
Yeah, I agree. And I will be writing about that over the course of the next month or two. Right now, the problem is I haven't written a lot of Common Dreams pieces recently because we have this book out, and every weekend I'm going someplace doing book tour, I'll get to it. And Andy, thank you for your kind words and for calling. And good point. You've motivated me. Margaret in Bremerton, Washington. Hey, Margaret.
Hi, Tom. I was wondering if you could explain how habeas corpus could be eliminated without a constitutional amendment.
It can't be. The Constitution says that habeas corpus can only be suspended with the permission of Congress during time of insurrection or invasion. And
right.
We are not experiencing an insurrection, and we have not experienced an invasion.
So how does this... I'm sorry.
So when Gordon Smith, the Republican senator from Oregon, took to the floor of the Senate to pontificate about why he was going to be voting for this incredibly toxic piece of legislation, he said words to the effect of, I don't have the quote or the printout in front of me, but I saw him on television, heard him say it. He said words to the effect of, we're just going to, you know, we don't know whether this habeas corpus part of this thing is going to be legal or not. We'll just have to let the courts, you know, figure it out. In other words, what they're saying is, we know the Supreme Court's going to strike this down. This is patently unconstitutional. But if we pass this law, it'll give cover to George W. Bush for the 2 years that it's going to take for it to work its way to the Supreme Court. And by that time, he'll no longer be president. And in the interim, the Democrats will not have, if they take control of the House and the Senate, which is why they were in such a hurry to pass this thing before the session ended, if the Democrats take control of either the House or the Senate, they will not have the legal ability to claim that Bush committed a crime and therefore impeach him for it. That's what this is all about. It's all about politics. Well, it's about that, and it's about grabbing this kind of power.
Okay, so even though it's against the Constitution, they can still do it.
Oh, sure.
For this time until the Supreme Court does something.
That's right. And it won't be the first time. This has happened many, many times in the past where Congress has passed laws where they knew full well that they were unconstitutional and they would be struck down by the Supreme Court, but they had some political agenda in mind, or they were trying to, you know, chip away at something, or they were trying to nudge something closer or farther away from a particular line. But they passed a piece of legislation knowing that it wouldn't withstand judicial scrutiny. That's the case here, absolutely. There's no doubt about it.
So if the Supreme Court then says this is unconstitutional, Bush still cannot be charged with anything that happened because of this law?
Well, no, it's more of a political reality, and that is that once a president is out of office, for example, you know, there's a fair amount of evidence that Bush Sr. collaborated with the Iranians to hold the hostages over the election of 1980 so that Jimmy Carter would lose to Reagan and Bush. But nobody's going to prosecute him for that now, even the Democrats, because, you know, the guy's out of office. You know, everybody kind of wants to move forward. Nobody's talking about Reagan's crimes with the Contras and like that. There are plenty of things that previous presidents could be held accountable for that, you know, just never happens. Or for that matter, previous members of Congress, because everybody sort of wants to move on, and there's always, you know, the scandal du jour. And so they figure if they can just keep George immunized so that he can't be prosecuted, and if he can't be prosecuted, then he also can't be impeached, because you have to impeach somebody for high crimes or misdemeanors, in other words, for breaking the law. So if they can change the law so that he didn't break it, at least for 2 years, then once he's out of office, somebody else is going to be president, and they'll be investigating that person. So, you know, that's the deal. Okay. So, Margaret, thanks for the call. Hey. I got to move along here. 1-866-440-8466. Dick in Seattle. Hey, Dick.
Yeah, you know, Tom, as much as Karl Rove's strategies and, of course, Tom DeLay's and Denny Hastert's K Street money seem to help Republicans beat Democrats, you know, I think it all still comes down to media presence and support, and that's really the Republicans' trump card. I mean, we've got Air American Keith Olbermann, and the Republicans pretty much, as far as I can see, own the rest of the corporate media. And they're
seizing control of public broadcasting.
Well yeah, they've had control of that with the Kevin CIA propagandist for years, you know.
Well, you saw the study that just came out of FAIR of the McNeil Lehrer report, or the News Hour with Jim Lehrer, where they found that all these wild imbalances. Republicans were outnumbered Democrats 2-1. You know, as guests on the program.
Oh, sure. That's the real reason congressional Democrats won't fight back. They're afraid of the corporate Republican media attacking them, not just all the right-wing talk media, but all the TV as well.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, Dick. And they know that there's this giant echo chamber, and there's a lot of power in that giant echo chamber. And you know, it's a tragedy. But also, that echo chamber may follow power, and when the people rise up and say, no, we really want the Democrats, maybe they'll go along. We'll see. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
I see trees of green, them blue. Loving you, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Alex Goldmark, Andrew Dunn, Clay Kaplis, and Lauren Kirshner at Air America Radio in New York, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thanks so much. It is much appreciated. 1-866-440-8466, Kate in Arcata, California. Hey, Kate.
Hi, Tom. I'm just wondering if what they may be trying to cover up Condoleezza Rice and the July 7th memo that they, or the meeting that they apparently can't remember. I followed up on the...
Well, they've now remembered it, and now Condi's latest excuse is that it the reason she didn't remember it was because it wasn't anything new.
Well, I followed
up... Which is really even more of an indictment in some way.
Right. Last week or several days ago, a caller called in about a meeting, that bin Laden was in the hospital in Dubai.
Yeah, at that time.
Pardon me? Yes.
At that time, yeah.
I looked it up. I found an article in The Guardian by Anthony Sampson, who's a well-known British author who died in 2004. But he said that this came from French intelligence, was given to Le Figaro, a French newspaper, that the reason that the French intelligence leaked this was to, quote, the French are keen to reveal the ambitious role of the CIA and to restrain Washington from extending the war to Iraq and elsewhere. And apparently according to this, when bin Laden was in the American hospital in Dubai from July 4th to July 14th, he met with the local CIA agent, and it's says here the CIA chief was seen in the elevator on his way to see bin Laden, and later it's alleged that he boasted to friends about his contact with bin Laden. He was recalled to Washington soon afterwards. So if this is all true, I looked up Anthony Sampson, the author, and found out that he had died in 2004. But if that's true, it's outrageous. I mean, because
what's even more outrageous is that that was reported in Western media, in quotes, you know, in the mainstream media of a major industrial power, and it was not followed up on by American media.
And under the byline of a respected author.
Right.
And this is during the time when they were clearly, what Clinton said, they were doing nothing. They knew that bin Laden was a threat and that he had attacked the coal, but he was responsible for it. Yet he was in the American hospital visited by the CIA. I mean, that's just, to me, that would be a huge... There's so many huge bombshells that don't seem to go anywhere, but this seems like one that really could go somewhere.
Yeah, it you would think, and I there might be a semi-innocent explanation for Bush's unwillingness to think that it was bin Laden. He might have actually thought that when the CIA and FBI determined that bin Laden was behind the USS Cole, that, you know, he knew that family. He knew them very well. He knew bin Laden's brother. His father is good friends with another one of bin Laden's brothers. He just might have said, I can't believe this of these guys. These are friends of mine. You know, that kind of thing. I mean, it's conceivable.
Well, you could see it's conceivable, but still it doesn't...
Doesn't excuse it.
No, it doesn't excuse it, and it definitely... I'm not sure how to follow up and find out more about this, but I think I'll keep trying.
Okay, well, let us know what you find, Kate.
I definitely will. Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for the call. Pam in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Pam.
Hi. I hate to call with such unformed ideas here, but I came in on this conversation you had just a little while back about, you know, the gal with the incompetence.
With our caller from Sacramento, yeah.
Yeah, and You know, these are things that I struggle with all the time. A psychologist would have a field day trying to figure out what goes on about this administration and where, you know, what drives them. But
well, one already has. A psychiatrist, Justin Frank, wrote a book called Bush on the Couch that's truly disturbing reading.
Well, I mean, I don't get a sense of him having a real strong ideology and of his own that he's thought out. And I don't see him as exactly a neocon. I do see him as somebody who believes that, who thinks that corporations running things is a good thing somehow. But, you know, they can't, I don't see them as competent. I mean, they can't have forgotten the lessons of all insurgencies all over the world that have lasted for years and years and years and years and years, that they know that they can't not be aware that they just don't give up, you know, people who are being occupied.
Right.
In countries.
And that for that matter, we wouldn't if we were being occupied.
And so the thing that comes up for me is that for some reason, whether it's for corporate gain or whatever, there is a reason that they wanted a forever war, a state of forever war.
Well, the answer to that, if that's the case, it's because they read George Orwell's 1984. And they read James Madison back in 1797, when he wrote that no nation can maintain its democracy in the state of perpetual war. He just came right out and said, you know, war is the greatest enemy to democracy. And the main reason is because it increases the power of the presidency.
Right, and so, I think that's what it's about. I think they do not believe in the free market because corporatocracy is not a free market. I believe that they believe in ultimate power and the ability to do whatever they want in terms
you're absolutely right,
greed.
You're absolutely, they believe in aristocracy. It's just that they're using the corporate form to establish that aristocracy rather than the historic form of aristocracy, which is inherited, you know, family, this, that, and the other thing. Anyhow, we have to wrap it up for the week. Thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you again on Monday. It's top of the hour. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.